at zoom.us.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, the national debt is now, according to the national debt clock, $21.8 trillion. It's gone up pretty dramatically over the last two decades. Well, one of the reasons why, according to our next guest, is spending on the military. The U.S. has spent more than $5.9 trillion since the 9/11 attacks on September 11, 2001, on prosecuting wars abroad. In addition, the death toll to civilians and soldiers has been enormous. An annual research project called The Cost of War was published 2 weeks ago by the Watson Institute for International Public Affairs at Brown University. That $5.9 trillion figure is nearly five times higher than the Pentagon's own official estimate because it includes all spending across the U.S. federal government that came as a consequence of these wars. Today on Radioactivity, we're going to talk with Boston University political science professor Nita Crawford, who co-directs the Cost of War program. The Watson Institute's report came out at the same time it was revealed that the Pentagon had failed its first ever audit. I spoke with Professor Watson about the trillions of dollars in war costs and how the spiraling costs might be brought under control. Professor Crawford, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
I want to ask about the Pentagon audit first. Just reading from Reuters 2 weeks ago, Reuters reported the Pentagon has failed what's being called its first ever comprehensive audit, a senior official said on Thursday, finding U.S. Defense Department accounting discrepancies that could take years to resolve. Results of the inspection conducted by some 1,200 auditors and examining financial accounting on a wide range of spending, including on weapon systems, military personnel, and property. But Deputy Secretary of Defense Patrick Shannon told reporters that we failed the audit, but we never expected to pass it. I want to ask you about the audit. This is the first ever comprehensive audit of the Pentagon. What did you make of it?
Well, it's enormous in two respects. First, the fact that they couldn't bother to do an audit for so many years after Congress had told them to do so. They asked for this audit decades ago. But secondly, that they weren't able to, with 1,200 accountants, reconcile their accounts. That has become an expenses. I'm surprised at the sort of scale of this enterprise and the lack of accountability. But in a third way, I've been watching these numbers for a long time, and they have indicated that they didn't expect to pass, and they sort of prepared us for this, that we wouldn't see a passing grade on the accounting.
The Pentagon has not been audited despite a law that says that all government agencies should be audited. That law was passed in 1990. Are there political reasons why the Pentagon was not audited?
I think that there are lots of reasons why the Pentagon isn't audited, and we tend not to in the United States, or hasn't been audited before, we tend not to really look with too many critical eyes at the institution we think is keeping us safe. That's one thing. They sort of get a blank check in many respects. And often, since 9/11, Congress has given the Pentagon more money than it has asked for. And then it is no surprise that in some ways they don't know what to do with that much money, and which is why some of this money has sort of disappeared into accounts, and they just don't have a good filing system for it.
Now, you're also involved in the Cost of War project, and you found that the U.S. has spent about $5.9 trillion for the post-9/11 wars. $5.9 trillion. That's a huge amount of money.
That's right. Well, it's not all Pentagon money, but most of it is Pentagon money, or a large portion of it. So the way we did the accounting was we looked at the direct military spending in the war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan, but these wars have also spilled over into Pakistan and Syria. And we looked at other DOD overseas contingency account money, which is, you know, money we spend in Africa, in Europe, and elsewhere on counterterrorism operations. So we added up all that DOD military spending. Then we added up the spending that the State Department does on war-related activity, and that's called this. All of that's called overseas contingency operations. So that's directly appropriated by the Congress for wars and in these war zones and other special operations. And you have to realize the United States has operations with special operations forces in 80 to 90 countries in the world. So it's more than the major war zones. And then you look at the increases to Department of Defense-based military spending that are war-caused and war-related. And these include things like the tens of thousands of people who remain in military service but who were injured in Iraq and Afghanistan or elsewhere in other operations related to these war on terror activities. They need greater health care within the Department of Defense, not to mention when they move into the Veterans Affairs systems. And there's also other increased expenses in the Department of Defense that are war-related. And then you look at things outside the DOD and the State Department, and you have expenses, of course, for the 3 million veterans who've now moved into the VA system, and we've got to provide for their health care into the next several decades. And then there's Department of Homeland Security spending, which is a large portion of spending on the to keep the United States safe from potential terrorist attack. And then there's interest spending. That is, these wars were not funded by taxes or by war bonds, as most other U.S. wars have been funded. And then, therefore, we have to pay interest on borrowing to pay for these wars. And that interest spend will, in the next few years, be much more, and it already has become, more than we spend on overseas contingency operations. So it's quite a lot of cost that you expect, direct war costs, war appropriations, and then there are things that sort of spin out and are war-related.
Well, $5.9 trillion, that's a pretty incredible number. And there's a lot that you said there I want to break down. We're talking with Professor Nita Crawford. She's the chair of the Political Science Department at Boston University. She helped write the Cost of War study that just came out. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. First of all, you said that other departments beyond the Pentagon are spending money and included in your $5.9 trillion. I'm surprised to hear you say that the State Department is involved in spending on war, because I always thought the State Department was kind of like the peaceful alternative to the Pentagon.
Right. Well, the State Department has several roles, and they have increased expenses because of the wars on terror that we've been fighting. One expense has been counter-narcotics and training of military and police, and basically the State Department is supplementing what the Department of Defense is doing. Okay, so it's sort of as if the State Department has become part of the DOD in some respects in the war zones. Then in addition, as we found out in Libya, when there is unrest, you need to spend a lot of money to secure embassies and other State Department facilities. So they're spending In Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan has increased just to keep the embassies that are there secure. So they've had to essentially militarize their own enclaves in the war zones. Mm-hmm. And then there's other basically economic support, which is actually supporting the military and police in these countries.
Yes,
the State Department is supposed to be an alternative, but it's actually supplementing the work of the DOD.
All right. So the other point that you raised there that just leaps out is that every time we increase military spending, every time we go to war, we're doing it on borrowed money.
That's right. Well, when the 9/11 attacks occurred, the United States was actually not in deficit spending. It had a surplus, a budget surplus. And then after the 9/11 attacks and since then, the United States has run a deficit annually. So we haven't raised taxes. As you know, we've cut taxes a couple times since the 9/11 attacks. And the debt, because of these annual deficits, the debt has increased. Now, but you obviously have to have money. So what do? You borrow it. You borrow it from other parts of the government, say Social Security Trust Fund, or you borrow it from China or Japan or other countries who are willing to buy your bonds or lend you money. So what this has done, this increased debt, left us with the fact that we have to pay interest on the debt. So it's like when you take out, you buy something on your credit card, and you don't pay the principal down, you just keep paying the interest. Well, obviously, the principal's never touched, and sometimes you can't pay even sort of your basics, and you have to make choices. So you cut the budget elsewhere so you can keep paying the interest. And that's what we've done. We sort of cut the budget in other areas of the government, plus we're paying interest on borrowing, and that's how we just keep these wars going.
One other statistic that just jumps out, and that is that the U.S. has military operations in the war on terror in 76 countries. Now, I think...
We actually don't know the right number. It's actually between 80 and 90, but we're not sure. They don't tell us.
Okay, so that is rarely talked about. I mean, it was tragic just a day or two ago when three U.S. soldiers and were killed in Afghanistan. We all pay attention, I think, somewhat to Afghanistan, certainly Iraq. Mm-hmm. But the other 78 or so countries, or 85 countries, whatever it is, we almost never hear about U.S. operations in those other countries.
That's right. They're basically unnamed war zones. And, you know, we do hear about things when they go wrong and people are killed or gravely injured. But, yes, we're in operating in counter-terror situation, counter-terrorist missions all over the world. Asia, Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean.
Either the press is not doing its job, or the U.S. does this in such secrecy that the press is unaware of it. I mean, what's your take about this? Is the press not doing its job in reporting the vast reach of the U.S. military in terms of military operations, or is it that these are all conducted in secrecy?
I think that the press has a hard time when the information is in public and when they feel deferential when they go to the Pentagon and they get the answer of we'll get back to you on that, and they never are given the information that they asked for. But the main problem is that I think that after the 9/11 attacks, and this is why the base military budget as well as war spending has been so high, everyone said, we need to be defended. We'll do whatever it takes. And then you don't question these activities. We haven't questioned. Congress has not questioned, not had many public hearings, but we don't understand these operations, therefore, as a public, because we're not given the information. But when you have a situation where essentially there's a lot of money, the DOD can do what it thinks best, because we let them, because we're afraid, then what happens, I think, is that it becomes so complicated and vast that it's hard for anybody to put two and two together and to sort of get the scale of this, the counterterror operations. So it's not that people in the press are falling down on the job. I think it's very difficult to do when the information is essentially behind a wall and it doesn't come out in congressional hearings, and it's not reported in a transparent way in the Pentagon. What they call green books. The comptroller puts out information. You can sort of track what's happening, but it's very difficult. It's like telling you how many nails you have in your house. The information isn't actually usable in the sense that we need to use it. It's some of it's out there. We just can't put it all together. It's not in a form that is understandable.
Well, our guest is Dr. Nita Crawford. She's a professor and chair of political science at Boston University, and we're talking about the Cost of War Project. This is WMNF in Tampa. Just going back to the reason why we started to spend this $5.9 trillion after 9/11, Osama bin Laden hired these guys from Saudi Arabia, mostly Saudi Arabia, to take flight lessons and then take over the airplanes. Out of that disaster, we invaded Afghanistan as if Afghanistan was somehow involved Osama bin Laden was a Saudi. He was a rich guy, came from a rich family. It really wasn't the Taliban there in Saudi Arabia, I mean, in Afghanistan, that caused 9/11. Yet we've been there since 2002. How does the Pentagon justify staying there? We never attacked Saudi Arabia, but what does the Pentagon say about, well, Afghanistan should be our target because of 9/11?
Okay, we'll go back to the initial decision that was made on September 11th, 2001. We took the assault by the aircraft as war. We could have taken it the other way, which is under international law, this is a crime, right? We could have decided that we would pursue these individuals, and we didn't yet have proof of who had done it, but we had a good idea, as criminals, right? And at other countries, when terrorism occurs, it's treated as a criminal act. And what you do is you use law enforcement means. In this case, we would have had to use international law enforcement means. The choice to invade Afghanistan, I think, was made because they were both what we might call complicit, I think this is true, and they were harboring those, in some cases, in some ways, unwillingly, this group of thugs and criminals, and they were turning or had become a failed state. And so if you think that your model is war and that you must, in fact, get the nest as well as the eggs that are in the nest, then that's what you do, and we've done. We've essentially said we have to control everything, everywhere, all the time, so something like 9/11 doesn't happen again. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to control everything in Afghanistan. There are more terrorists there now than there were after the 9/11 attacks, right, through ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban, more militants, right? And the war is at stalemate. This is a failed war. We didn't have to make that choice. War wasn't necessary. Other things could have been tried, you know, and then if those failed, maybe do something else. But we just decided sort of in a knee-jerk way, reflexively, to go to war. And we stayed there because it's not solvable this way. We keep trying the same thing. We keep hitting the militants or people we think are militants, killing them, but often killing civilians, which leads to increased militancy. All the research shows, or at least most of the research shows, that when you kill innocent people, the people who survive are upset about that, understandably, as we were after 9/11. So they respond by supporting militants or by becoming militants themselves to sort of get this awful military presence out of their country. So the war grinds on. We're in a tit-for-tat cycle. We have to get out of it. But because there's no plan to get out of the conflict, it just keeps going on. And we have, in fact, scheduled in Afghanistan, or at least where the DOD's planning on being there, at least through 2023. Meanwhile, we're at stalemate. And much of the country is controlled by the Taliban.
What's been the civilian death toll in all these operations in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and around the world that the U.S. has been involved in since 9/11 to tamp down terrorism? How many civilian deaths have there been?
Well, no one knows for sure, but it's about 250,000 people. Civilians have died in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and probably another 500,000 have been killed in Syria. But again, these numbers are debated. It's very hard. You know, when you leave places in rubble, as both the militants and the U.S. does, not everybody is counted. Mm. So, but this is the best estimate that various sources have, and I've added them up, and it's about 250,000 in these war zones. Then you add the 500,000 people likely killed in Syria. Of course, the U.S. isn't, and its allies are not killing all those people. Militants kill many of the people, or they're killed in crossfire. In other words, we chose war. We've been at war. This is what you get. You get civilians killed.
The federal deficit is rising. These wars have been conducted on borrowed money. I think conservatives don't like to think that the Pentagon and related functions caused the deficit, but I think from your report, it certainly does. Is there a danger that the U.S. could spiral into deeper and deeper debt as these wars continue?
It's a reality. The U.S. is in deeper debt. You have to make choices. You have to do an analysis of cost effectiveness. If the wars are not effective, it doesn't seem to be in Afghanistan at least, yet they're costing us this money, we have to do an analysis of the cost effectiveness. What are the costs, risks, and benefits? We've given them a blank check, assuming that we're getting a lot of benefits. Yet, you know, the spending, the military spending itself, which is more than half of discretionary spending, just keeps rising. And we have to ask, what are we not doing to secure ourselves at home? You know, education, infrastructure, healthcare, that we could be doing instead of this policy.
If you were to compare, let's say that we spend $1 million on the military and provide bombs and arm soldiers and pay soldiers' salaries, or if you spend $1 million here at home on infrastructure, which creates more jobs?
Well, spending on the military, $1 million would create about 7 or so jobs, you know, directly and indirectly. $1 million of military spending produces some jobs. If you spend it on education or healthcare, you can create more jobs than that. You can create, in fact, sometimes twice as many jobs, depending on the sector. So military spending, yes, is productive of jobs, but it is not productive in the same way of, say, spending on solar or transportation or education and healthcare. It's just inefficient. And you don't do military spending to create jobs, or at least we shouldn't be. But since some people argue that their state will be hurt, think about if you close a military base or reduce military spending, you could actually be producing more jobs.
President Trump says that during the Obama years, we didn't spend enough money on the military and that the military was weak and underfunded. So immediately when the president got into office, he added something like $50 or $60 billion to the Pentagon budget, which was approved by Congress. What would you say when the president says that President Obama left the U.S. military weak and underfunded, based on your study, on the cost of war study, what do you think?
That's not true. The military had plenty of money. They can't even account for all their money. Underfunded? I don't think so. I think what we have here is an institution that cannot keep track of its money. It has, in fact, through the Obama administration, through the Bush administration before that, through the Clinton administration before that, and now the Trump administration, a budget that well exceeds its rivals. There has been no dramatic decline in U.S. military spending. Since 2001, we've well exceeded the spending of our major rivals combined. Now, if, as the recent Pentagon report indicates, the U.S. is still not prepared to meet the challenges posed by its rivals, then we have to ask ourselves, well, were they inefficient with the spending, or was there waste or fraud or abuse? How can you have this much money, many times more than what your rivals spend, and not be prepared? It's a question we should all ask. How could they have done this? If a contractor came to your house and spent all this money and said this, and the house still wasn't done, you'd say, well, what did you do with the money? Everybody, if you spent this much money, my neighbor would have a fantastic house. What did you do with our money? We have to wonder.
Professor Crawford, one last question. How would you envision this, the information that you published in the Cost of War study for the Watson Institute, how would you envision this to be used by members of Congress and others who are looking at both U.S. security and the national deficit, government spending, and the good use of our federal tax dollars?
There's two ways. First of all, we have to ask about the strategy to end these wars. The strategy seems to be keep spending money, keep killing people, and somehow there'll be a good outcome. We have to ask, after 17 years in Afghanistan, more than 15 years in Iraq, if that's the right strategy. Secondly, we have to ask ourselves, is there something else that is more pressing that the United States should be doing? Okay, and here we look at climate change, which the international and national reports have shown us is the most pressing concern in terms of our national security, and say to ourselves, well, shouldn't we actually be investing in something else? And there is actually, I think a third thing that I'd like to see Congress address, which is, let's talk about accountability here and the role of this branch of government in declaring war and holding on to the power of the purse, using the power of the purse. When the Pentagon has essentially enough money that they can, on August of 2014, turn on a dime and go to war in Syria, they had enough money to do that without congressional authorization. They have too much money, right? We need to question the relationship then between Congress and the war-making capacity.
We certainly make unemployed people and people on food stamps and people that are getting what used to be called welfare, we make them go through hoops, we drug test them, and we make it really hard to get this government money, this taxpayer money, but we don't seem to have the same kind of like strictures or accounting procedures or hurdles when it comes to spending money to go to war.
That's right, because we're often in the beginning of a conflict told that the wars that they're going to go fight will be efficient, effective, they'll be over quickly, people will be back before the leaves fall or whatever. You know, promises can be made about this fast, effective, precise war. And often, in fact, almost every time the wars drag on, they don't do what we hope that they will do. People are injured and killed, and then we have to help them for decades afterwards. And we're often given this sort of rosy picture, which does not live up to the reality of conflict, and we don't reassess. And it's been very hard to reassess this conflict because the essentially too few people in the United States are faced with it in a day-to-day way, unlike during the Vietnam War. And in a sense, we haven't paid the fiscal price for it. We haven't, because it's been on borrowed money, we haven't had to have our taxes raised or been told to buy war bonds, urged to buy war bonds. Now, if we'd had those sort of immediate costs, it would be easier to keep these wars in the forefront of our consciousness. But I'm telling you that decades from now, we'll still be paying for these wars because of their long duration and the number of veterans who will require care over the next several decades. And we're obligated to care for them. We must care for them. But we have to think very carefully about the next conflict that the United States might get into and whether or not we can believe the rosy, optimistic predictions about inexpensive, effective, efficient, precise, and controllable. Those are never the results of going to war.
And we're already hearing the sabers rattle about Iran. Dr. Nita Crawford, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
It's been my pleasure.
Well, that was Professor Nita Crawford, who's a political scientist at Boston University. She co-directs the Cost of War program. You can find it online at watson.brown.edu/costs of war. And their annual report just came out. Total cost of the wars on terror since 9/11, $5.9 trillion. The national debt clock right now, $21.8 trillion. So about one quarter of that national debt can be attributed to all that borrowed money that went to fighting the wars that the U.S. is fighting around the world. If you want to comment about this, you can email us in the studio. Our address is dj@wmnf.org, or you can call up at 813-239-9663. If you want that website and you didn't get a chance to write it down, just email me your email and tell me that you want a link to that website, Costs of War, and I'll send you one via email. Our address here is dj@wmnf.org. All right, so we can talk about the borrowed money used to fight the wars since 9/11. There's some other news stories, too, that we can talk about. We're going to open up the phone lines right now. Jan Simpson is our phone producer today. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Some other items in the news that we could talk about. In Hillsborough County, Commissioner Stacy White on the Hillsborough County Commission today filed a lawsuit challenging that local transportation tax that was recently passed by voters in Hillsborough County. Just reading from his press release today, he says, today I filed a lawsuit in my official capacity as a county commissioner to take a stand against the Hillsborough County transportation referendum that passed in November. He says this referendum, which created a transportation surtax in our county charter, was drafted and financed by a small group of private citizens without any public vetting to place a 1% transportation surtax in our county charter, projected to raise about $10 billion in new taxes over the next 30 years. White says in his lawsuit, the amendment unlawfully delegates the responsibility of the Hillsborough Board of County Commissioners to allocate transportation surtax dollars to an unelected group of unknown people who do not answer to the voters or any higher authority. That's his complaint. Hillsborough County Commissioner Stacy White filing a lawsuit against the transportation tax in Hillsborough County. And we can talk about that, too. Again, if you want to make a comment, you can send your comment into dj@wmnf.org. Well, jury selection is getting started in West Palm Beach in a long-running lawsuit involving a wealthy, well-connected financier accused of sexually abusing dozens of teenage girls over several years. 65-year-old Jeffrey Epstein pleaded guilty back in 2008 to state sex charges. He served just over a year in jail, and he became a registered sex offender. In a secret deal with federal prosecutors led by now Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta, who's in the Trump administration, Epstein avoided a federal indictment that could have meant a life prison sentence. The Miami Herald did a major investigative piece about this last week. Witness lists indicate that some of the young victims could testify in the lawsuit trial. It's expected to last about 10 days. And we could talk about that. Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. And if you want that Cost of War website, I will email it to you. Just email me here in the studio, dj@wmnf.org, and I'll send it back to you. Some other items in the news, lots of news going on. A deputy in Fort Lauderdale has been reprimanded for wearing a patch representing the right-wing conspiracy theory QAnon when he met with Vice President Mike Pence. Sergeant Mike Patton of the Broward County Sheriff's Office was given a written reprimand yesterday. He was also removed from a joint investigations division with federal agents and the agency's SWAT department. Television station WFOR in Fort Lauderdale reports that the deputy, Patton, wore the Q patch on his official uniform when he met with Pence last Friday while serving as part of the security detail for the vice president's visit to South Florida. QAnon is a right-wing conspiracy theory that started online, on an online message board. It says that there's a deep state and that President Trump is trying to undo the deep state. The sheriff's office says wearing the patch violated its employees' conduct policy. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Reading from DeMarco's email, he sends this in. He says, not to speak ill of the dead, but there was no outcry from Kuwait for the U.S. to save them from Iraq. George H.W. Bush engineered the war to overcome the Vietnam syndrome and is the reason we've been mired in endless wars ever since. He led Iraq to believe that we had no interest in an Arab dispute. Saddam Hussein has been our guy, or had been our guy, up until then. And then there was an issue of agricultural credits to Iraq being diverted to cover military aid. H.W. Bush was arming Iraq against Iran, and according to Henry Gonzalez, the congressman, the U.S. was shipping arms, including components for nuclear weapons, up to the day he drew a line in the sand and put boots on the ground, writes DeMarco about President Bush. All right, DeMarco, thank you for that. Adam writes this regarding the transportation lawsuit in Hillsborough County. Adam writes, they should throw that lawsuit out right away. What is it with Republicans trying to usurp the will of the people? Over 57% of voters approved the transportation referendum in Hillsborough County. Why doesn't the county commissioner respect the people's will? What is his reasoning for going against the will of the people, writes Adam. And again, you can call us up if you've got thoughts about any of these news items we've been talking about. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Bo in Clearwater. Bo, you're on WMNF. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I was appalled to see that police officer had that QAnon or whatever that patch was, but I wasn't surprised. Being from St. Louis, Missouri originally, I don't know if you've seen on the news that four cops in St. Louis were having fun beating protesters, which I'm familiar with having a protest throughout St. Louis and even on union picket lines, been harassed by cops. You know, it's just a shame that, you know, it doesn't matter. Well, I mean, it's, you know, when you're poor, it seems like the cops pick on you more, whether no matter the color of your skin. But I think it's just a shame, and I'm really appalled at that. And I think he should have been. I'd be afraid of him being a cop with his thought process. That's all I have to say.
All right, Bo, thanks a lot. Thanks. I was at the Donald Trump rally at the end of July in Tampa at the fairgrounds, and there were a sizable number of people wearing QAnon stickers and holding up signs suggesting that there was this vast conspiracy and that President Trump was undoing the deep state, whatever that is. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of different ideas about what the deep state is. I think the QAnon people think that there's a secret cabal of people that President Trump is trying to undo. There are other people who think that there's a secret cabal of people that's loosely organized that really tends to align with powerful special interests like polluters, and that's the deep state, that they're always embedded in administrations allowing polluters and people that are against labor laws to infiltrate the federal government. But the QAnon theory is very interesting, because part of the theory is that there's a guy there's a video of this guy talking who reveals the truths about the deep state. And I've watched some of those videos, and they're just bonkers, I gotta say. Here's the number to call, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Laurie writes this: thanks for airing that speech by Arturo Vargas on why the 2020 census matters. I will tell you, I worked on the 2010 census, and it was the biggest mess I had ever been involved in. I finally quit. It was so understaffed and disorganized. This is so incredibly stressful. And in this talk, Mr. Vargas states that there will be less funding and fewer employees for the 2020 census. What a joke, writes Lori. So, Lori, thank you for your thoughts. If you've got thoughts that agree or disagree with anything you've heard here so far, please feel free to call us up, 813-239-9663. Thanks to Jan Simpson. She's our phone producer today. Let's go to Matthew in Odessa. Matthew, thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good.
I was traveling a lot when I was younger, and it was great. You know, you go to all these far-flung places like the Middle East or Asia or, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and people always loved Americans. It was great because, you know, oh, you're from America. Oh, I'm so excited. You know, it was nice because, you know, they see everything on TV. You think it's like Baywatch, you know, Dynasty. Girls are jumping in bed with you wherever you go. But the only times you'd have bad experiences was when you were near a military base. You didn't even know there was one there. But when there was a military base there, ugh, Americans, ugh. They just turn their nose up, ugh. And I was trying to figure out why, and it's because all the soldiers, these teenage men, who, you know, tend to like to go out and have a hard time drinking, would cause havoc for all the locals. And that's another unseen cost that these bases we strung all across the world. All the drunken men, you know, not all of them, of course, but enough to cause the locals to be really sick of them.
Yeah, there was just an election in Japan. I think it was in Okinawa, and the new leader, I think he's the governor of Okinawa, was campaigning, wanting to get the U.S. base out of there because it disrupted the civilian population, and they've been, the base has been there since the end of World War II. And I think that's how this new leader in Japan got elected in the prefecture of Okinawa. I think that's what they call them there in Japan.
That's right. That's right. And that would have, when I lived in Japan, it was the same thing. People were nice until you got near a base. When you got near a base, they kind of stuck their nose up at you because of all the trouble, these fired up, hyped up, you know, killing machines that the Army wants to pump out. And boy, they when they go out in the town, it can get really ugly for the locals.
All right, Matthew, thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, good to hear from you. Tony writes this, a great presentation by Professor Crawford. We used to pay for wars by higher taxes, up to 90% on the rich in World War II, and war bonds. Tax breaks for the super wealthy did little to help ordinary people. Instead, we suffer with third world infrastructure, poor medical care for many, threats to Social Security and Medicare we elders have paid for. Why aren't more Americans apoplectic about this? That's Tony in St. Pete. I think the fact that we borrow money, and you hear especially conservatives worried all the time about the borrowed money that goes into the federal budget that increases the national debt. But the one thing that conservatives never talk about is the military budget. And are all these wars really necessary? What do you think? 813-239-9663. Matthew, thanks for your phone call. Let's go to Hugh in Dover. Hugh, you're on WMNF.
For taking my call. I also would like to say that I really enjoyed the commentary, too, from the professor.
Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
What do you want to say?
Well, in 1989, I went to work for World Bank of Missouri in St. Louis, and a lot of people there know one of the commercial lenders. His name was George Youssef, and the guy was just, you know, amazing. And a lot of what the city planners would do is they would use, you know, George, because, you know, he knew so many different aspects of what it would take to build a particular building, you know, sky rises or even, you know, small projects, you know, from the little to the big. And I don't understand how it is that we could have survived this long as a country and not have people like him, commercial lenders, you know, that know, you know, the soil analysis that you need, you know, in order to build a project, and just all the different aspects, how much the materials cost, how much the labor is. And if the people weren't doing their job, you know, on time, they had a schedule, then they simply didn't get paid. And I think that, you know, the government could benefit greatly by hiring people like that.
People that were good project managers. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of good project managers in government. I think a lot stems from the top down. What are the projects? Go ahead. How does this fit in?
Well, what I meant to say is not so much the military people that are doing the work, but the commercial lenders, the people that, since you're borrowing money to begin with, you need to have a bank analyst like Mr. Youssef that sits there and tells you how your money is being spent. And he's actually in control of what gets paid. When, you know, when you go to purchase materials, you don't just borrow money and get $720 million. They don't just write you a blank check. They put someone like him in charge. When I worked for Citibank, there were three people. Anything over $700 million, it would take three people. And that would, if I remember correctly, it was George Collins and George Goodman, I believe, Mr. Goodman and Mr. Collins and somebody else. But anyway, you know, it's more than one person that's helping analyze, you know, how these projects are going, what's being done, what materials are being used, where they're being purchased from. And, you know, if the government isn't doing the steps that most major banks use in completing their projects, then like she said, you know, they have no idea how they're spending their money.
Yeah, the Pentagon just failed its first ever audit, and that news came out on the 15th of November. And the Pentagon was supposed to undergo an audit. President Trump wanted it to undergo an audit, and they failed it. They couldn't account for trillions of dollars of stuff that they had bought.
Well, and a lot of times audits, bank audits, they're called internal audits. And primarily what they do is they determine how much insurance is required to protect the bank in their financial interest. So basically, you know, they're just people that are determining how much insurance the bank needs to limit their risk.
But you still see President Trump going out in the campaign trail saying that he's going to continue to fund the military and he's going to give them more money. Last year, he gave them, I undersold it in that interview I did with Professor Crawford. The actual number that President Trump gave to the military in his first year in office was $80 billion that the military didn't even ask for. So, you know, the Pentagon budget has been inflated, and this is all borrowed money. That's what gets me. I mean, to your point, too, if you're going to borrow money, make sure you spend it well. But the Pentagon didn't even ask for that additional $80 billion.
Wow.
Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, you. Great to hear from you. Well, we've got an open line you'd be able to get through right away. 813-239-9663. Here's Mike's email from Sarasota. Mike writes this. Your guest was right. America has paid and will pay a horrible price for endless war in many places with no real oversight or even recognition of where we are fighting. Even senators were surprised to find that American soldiers were fighting in Niger. How many more Nigers are there? But here's the larger point, writes Mike. He says the problem is that American presidents do the politically popular thing, and war is popular, says Mike. George W. Bush or H.W. Bush's popularity reached 90% after he invaded Panama. Also, spending money is popular. Every new president in Congress breaks new records in spending more, but not spending on defense, health care, Social Security, or infrastructure will get you voted out of office, so will raising taxes. The American system is broken, writes Mike. The political system is addicted to more spending, writes Mike in Sarasota. I was surprised by interviewing Professor Nita Crawford of Boston University, who is part of the Cost of War Project. And she said, you heard in that interview, she said that the U.S. is involved militarily in action in 80 to 90 countries. That's not just kind of sitting on a military base. That is militarily involved. Now, I should have asked her what those 80 or 90 countries were. That she would have taken 10 minutes, I think, to read the list. But that's certainly not what I understand by watching television from time to time or listening to radio from time to time or reading newspapers every day. I don't hear of our military action. And Mike makes a good point. Niger is one country where American soldiers have been killed in the last few months. But 80 to 90 countries where U.S. military action is taking place, that's huge. And I think it's up to our media to tell us where that is. Where are these countries? Well, again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. It's not a surprise to those of you listening at MacDill Air Force Base, but I think to most of us, it is a surprise. Let's go back to the phones. We can go to Bob in Ruskin. Hey, Bob, you're on WMNF. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks. Yeah, your point about borrowing money is absolutely right, I got to say. One thing, though, it's a little misplaced, is if you look at the total federal budget and we borrow again, a full two-thirds of it are transfer payments to people through, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, various other programs, Social Security as well.
And but those are programs that
two-thirds.
Those are programs that you and I pay into. You and I, those of us that work for a living, and I'm sure you do, Bob. You pay a Social Security tax. You pay a Medicare tax.
Right.
So
but
these are even though
more than they pay in, unfortunately. And
well, that's
like
that's
that. So
really
we
not
heavily for.
That's really not true. I don't think people get paid much more than they pay in.
Absolutely true. Come on, that's well documented. But
by documented where?
Is your right that
no? Wait a minute, Bob. Documented where that we pay, we get more in Social Security payments than we pay in. A lot of people die before they reach the age of 65. I think the biggest cost. And we don't borrow money to pay for Social Security. We don't borrow money to pay for Medicare. We borrow money to go to war. Now, is that okay with you?
Thing in closing, so we borrow money for the defense budget too. But 2/3 of the budget is transfer payments to people, which is
we never borrow money to pay for Social Security. We do not borrow any money to pay for Social Security. The Social Security Trust Fund has a $2 trillion surplus right now, so we don't borrow any money to pay for Social Security. I think there are people that want us to believe that we borrow money to pay for Social Security. Social Security is a net positive for the U.S. and for the balance sheets in the U.S. Where we borrow money is to pay for the military. And that's really the thing that I think is undercovered by most press in this country, and that's why MNF is doing this story.
Look at what the cost of the total budget. The defense budget is a large line item, but it's not even a quarter of the a third of the
Of the money that is borrowed, of the money that, you know, that we borrow every year. Most of that goes to pay for the military. It doesn't go to pay for Medicare or Social Security. And I think that's, Bob, that's where you're dead wrong. And I think you're following a line of bunk that's been sold to you. We do not borrow money to pay for Social Security. We do not borrow money to pay for Medicare. And that's the bunk. That's the line of bunk that you're following.
No, that's not true. You're right about Social Security. People pay in, but many people, almost everybody gets more benefits out than they pay.
So yeah, but if you get more money from benefits, it doesn't mean that you're borrowing money. I mean, even if I accept your premise, which I don't, but even if I accept it, we're not borrowing money to pay for Social Security. We're not borrowing money to pay for Medicare. Bob, we're stuck, and I think rather than just you and I go back and forth, Let's get some numbers, and I'll find some experts that can discuss this in a thoughtful way, and then we'll get to the bottom of it, okay?
Start with government programs. It's easy to solve, and it's primarily transfer payments to people.
No, it's not. It's not transfer. We do not borrow money. Bob, we're stuck, and I don't think you're listening to me. But, Bob, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you, and let's go to Marie in Odessa. Marie, you're on WMNF.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, good. How about yourself?
Good.
The reason I was calling is because you mentioned something that caught my attention. You said that we have a broken system, and you're absolutely right. Our system is broken because we do not, our government is not, has no clarity. They do a lot of things in the background that us, the news don't know, so we don't know. The budget, that needs to be like on a monthly or annually. Or biannually, when they have a budget, they need to let us know where the money's going to. It's our taxes. It's our money. And sometimes we should vote on where it's used. And when it comes to who sits in the White House, the presidency, that should be better vetted. Right now, our deficit's going to grow more because we have a man that doesn't know how to budget. He just knows how to spend, and then go bankruptcy. So our government is in bad shape. I hope we survive this next 2 years.
Yeah, I do too. All right, Marie, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And Mike writes this regarding our caller Bob. He says your caller Bob is regurgitating Republican talking points. Thank you for that. I will do another show. We've done probably a dozen shows about Social Security and Medicare in the last year, but I will do another one just so we can get Bob on the right track, because I think Bob's lost. Let's go to Tim in Tampa. Tim, you're on. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I'd just like to say I agree with you 100%, meaning if I would do anything for this government, I would hire forensic accountants, and every penny of that Pentagon money will have to be shown where it's going and what you're doing with it before you get another dime. I did 20 years in the military, and there is so much waste, fraud, and abuse, and that's just a little 10% that I knew about. So my point is, you know, you can stop every social program in America. That will not put a dent in that budget until you deal with that military budget. And for some reason, they do not want us to know where that money is going. All you need to do is hire forensic accountants and say, listen, Pentagon, you're not getting another penny. We're going to pay the soldier's salary, but all these special projects, all these planes, these tanks, all that stuff is going on hold till we can figure out where the money is.
Yeah, you know, one of our first engineers here at WMNF worked in avionics for one of the branches of the military locally, and he said that he threw out perfectly good parts every month. He threw out perfectly good parts of airplanes just because he could. And he was ordered by his higher-ups to do so.
There's so much waste. And I would tell you, looking at those hedge funds, there are so many of these politicians involved in these hedge funds for these new tanks, these new technology, and all these things that the Pentagon buys. They're not even touching that. So, I mean, you're right. This budget, this country is going to fail financially if we don't stop, put the brakes on, and figure out where our money is going.
All right, Tim, thanks a lot. Thank you. Thanks. Good to hear from you. Thanks for the call. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned because your hero, Mark Bureau, is coming up next. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg.